Parker and Capulet Teddy would stop biting their thumbs at each other and engage in armed combat. The former was too agile an adversary, however, to allow himself to be directly challenged. Whenever Roosevelt seemed to be on the point of exploding, Parker would unfold a deft compliment or make some unexpected conciliatory gesture, which suddenly relieved the pressure. A case in point occurred on 1 May when Parker interrupted a regular meeting to announce that it was time for the annual election of the president of the board. There was an amazed silence. Roosevelt said that he did not understand. Avery Andrews challenged the legality of such a step. Surely a president, once elected, remained so for the duration of the board. Parker suggested that somebody consult the statute book. Tension mounted while a clerk flicked the pages over. Parker had never yet been proved wrong on any point of law. Not until the moment of confirmation did Parker propose, with a smile, that Theodore Roosevelt be renominated. "What are you doing it for?" Lincoln Steffens asked. "Oh, just for ducks," said Parker. "Just to see the big bomb splutter, the boss leader of men blow up." He continued to evade Roosevelt so successfully that when the long-threatened explosion came, its victim was not himself, but City Controller Ashbel P. Fitch. The latter was a waspish, bearded Democrat whose habit of rejecting the police department's more questionable bills, such as payment for children reporting Sunday excise law violations, was a constant irritation to Roosevelt. On 5 May, the president of the police board arrived at City Hall for a meeting of the Board of Estimate, attired in a new tweed suit whose checks, according to the World, were distinctly audible at 20 paces. He was seen to admire himself in a looking-glass before sitting down and facing Fitch across the mayor's table. The controller listened impassively while Roosevelt requested that $11,000 of surplus construction funds be transferred to finance his second annual campaign against the saloons, just then beginning. "I doubt that we can do it legally," Fitch replied, and launched into a speech about the impropriety of taxpayers' money being used to bribe stool pigeons on a Sunday. Roosevelt, his collar visibly rising, explained that policemen could not arrest saloon keepers for selling liquor illegally without buying it themselves or paying somebody to buy it for them. The money came out of their own pockets, and they were entitled to be reimbursed. "Yes, yes," Fitch interrupted. "The same old story, we've heard it before." "If we are brought to a standstill," Roosevelt hissed with clenched fists, "if we have to shut down in our work, it is your fault." "Oh, stop scolding," said Fitch. He suggested that Roosevelt ask a court for the money. The dialogue, which was transcribed by several eyewitnesses, continued as follows. Roosevelt, white with rage, jumping to his feet.
"You are the one to blame."
Fitch, lolling back in his chair.
"Tush, tush. I won't discuss the matter with you in this fashion. You're always looking for a fight."
Roosevelt,
"I fight when I am attacked."
Fitch, idly. "Oh, go on. I don't want to fight with you." Toys with pencil. Roosevelt, snapping his teeth.
"I know you won't fight. You'll run away."
Fitch, "Well, I wouldn't run away from you at all events." Roosevelt, shouting.
"You dare not fight."
Fitch, "Oh, I don't, hey? Just name your weapons. What do you want, pistols?" Roosevelt,
"Pistols or anything else?"
Dancing with rage. At this point, wrote the World correspondent, two reporters who were in the line of fire dropped their notes and dodged under the table. Fitch was no man to challenge lightly, being the unscarred winner of some 30 sword fights at the University of Heidelberg. Fortunately, Mayor Strong, who had been listening to the whole exchange with trembling eyelids, made one of the few decisive gestures of his administration. He raised a rheumatic fist and brought it down on the table with a crash. Strong, wincing.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen,
I warn you right now that if this thing goes on, I shall call in the police and have you both arrested."
Fitch.
"Oh, this man Roosevelt is always getting into a row. He had a row with Parker, now he wants a row with me."
The matter was referred to Corporation Counsel, and Roosevelt stalked out in a towering rage. Later, he calmed down and told reporters that there would be no duel. But it was too late to avoid headlines, and for days afterward, press and public rejoiced in the story. The Tribune bet on Roosevelt, who was always in condition to whip his weight in wildcats, while the yellow press came out strongly for Fitch. The Evening Post, anxious as ever to avoid bloodshed, suggested a meeting in the City Hall Plaza with fire department hoses at 30 paces. But popular opinion was in favor of a real duel. Offers of seconds and executors came in from as far away as Philadelphia, and Fitch was reported to have collected a small arsenal of gift weapons. One enormous horse pistol, adapted to fire peas, putty, and spitballs, was sent to the mayor by a citizen concerned for his safety. Strong was immensely tickled. "I shall use this at all future board meetings," he declared. Actually, William Strong had begun to sympathize with his beleaguered police commissioner. However much he might regret Roosevelt's hot-headedness, he liked the man and admired his decency. As for Parker, who had been seen gleefully slapping Fitch on the back after the Board of Estimate meeting, the mayor regretted ever having appointed him. He had done so in response to intense pressure by the county Democracy, which supported his reform ticket in 1894. And now the taste of that particular compromise was bitter in his mouth. Parker's obstructionism, absenteeism, and indolence had all but halted the work of the police department. Morale was sinking steadily, and the crime rate was climbing in proportion. Chief Conlon had become so depressed, while still doggedly supporting Parker, as to request sick leave in Europe. The 55-year-old officer was said to be ready to quit, and wanted only to lead his men in a final parade up Fifth Avenue before handing in his badge. The worst news, as far as Strong was concerned, was that Parker, casting around for a new ally, had managed to ensnare Commissioner Grant. Both men were now boycotting police board meetings, leaving Avery Andrews as Roosevelt's only faithful supporter, and even Andrews was beginning to show signs of polite impatience with the deadlock. The final straw came when Roosevelt approached the mayor with evidence showing that Parker was corrupt. A patrolman named McMorrow had signed an affidavit dated 20 April 1896, stating that he had bought his appointment for $400, the understanding being that it was to be done through Commissioner Parker. Roosevelt was reluctant to publicize this affidavit, since it would seriously damage his board's reputation for personal honesty, and he could not be entirely sure of the evidence. He asked Strong to intervene. On 20 May, therefore, the mayor wrote Parker a private letter saying that the honor of the city required that he step down, and intimating that certain sensational facts would be released to the press if he did not resign within 7 days. Parker replied with cold indifference, "I shall serve out my term regardless." He followed up with an open attack on Roosevelt for the benefit of a recorder interviewer. "Ever since his appointment as a police commissioner, he's assumed that he is the alpha and omega of the department. For 11 months, I have patiently endured this arbitrary assumption of authority. Colonel Grant and myself finally decided that unless Mr. Roosevelt recognized us as possessing equal authority to himself, we would take steps for protecting ourselves." Mayor Strong allowed the 7-day deadline to pass without releasing the McMorrow statement, but let it be known that Parker had been asked to resign. The news broke on 28 May, just as Chief Conlon returned from Europe to lead the annual parade of New York's finest. Roosevelt had canceled last year's event, saying that, "We will parade again when we have something to boast about." He was not feeling particularly boastful in the spring of 1896 either, yet there was a lot to be said, psychologically speaking, for a show of unity in the ranks. Despite reports of discontent and renewed corruption from various precincts, he was convinced that the bulk of the men were heartily desirous of being honest, and if Parker was to be fired, as the mayor kept promising, the department's moral regeneration would surely continue. On the 1st of June, he found himself gripping the rails of a reviewing stand at 40th Street and 5th Avenue. Magnificent sunshine warmed his tails and top hat, and he enjoyed a rare moment of repose as the drumbeats grew louder downtown. His fellow commissioners were on their best behavior. Mayor Strong beamed kindly upon him. He, in turn, grinned wider and wider at his first sight of the force en masse. More than 2,000 men came up the avenue in wave after wave of blue surge, their white gloves rising and falling like lines of foam, their helmets and brass buttons coruscating. Chief Conlon led the way on an immense bay horse whose coat was rubbed and curried to the sheen of satin. The crowd gave him a thunderous ovation, but saved its biggest roar for the bicycle squad, an innovation of Commissioner Andrews, 24 burly patrolmen wobbling determinedly along on wheels. The parade was adjudged a smashing success and redounded greatly to the credit of President Roosevelt. At its conclusion, he was mobbed by cheering well-wishers and horses had to be brought in to clear an escape route for him. But the sound of marching bands had hardly died away before public attention was drawn to renewed hostility between the commissioners. Amid rumors that Strong had again demanded Parker's resignation and again been refused, the police board assembled for a regular meeting on Wednesday, 3 June. It proceeded to give the most convincing demonstration yet of its inability to function as an administrative body. Roosevelt listened stonily while Commissioner Grant offered as a treaty of peace a new set of rules governing promotions. He was willing to approve the rules, anything to get the department moving again, but was in no mood to tolerate any more obstructionism from across the table. Only that morning the Herald had published a humiliating cartoon of himself being crushed by Parker in the form of a great smiling weight, while the caption inquired, "Will the strong man lift it?" Predictably, Parker waited until both Roosevelt and Andrews had expressed their approval of the rules before subjecting every one to destructive legal analysis. Roosevelt's face darkened to deep red, and beads of sweat stood out on his forehead as the maddening voice droned on, stinging him with insults that passed too quickly for retort. The two men stared steadily into each other's eyes, forgetful of other people in the room, obsessed by their struggle for supremacy. When Roosevelt spoke in reply, his voice sounded surprisingly deep and guttural, and every word was bitten into precise syllables, a sure sign of danger to those who knew him. One of the items of agenda awaiting discussion was the new police revolver, a .32-caliber double-action 4-inch Colt. Reporters watched in fascination as the president of the board absent-mindedly fondled it, then, still talking, picked it up and shook it slowly and impressively in Parker's face. On this occasion, it was Roosevelt who controlled himself, and Roosevelt who won. After 4 hours of relentless pressure, Parker, pale with exhaustion, agreed to the adoption of the rules. But he still obstinately refused to confirm the promotions of Brooks and McCullough, much less resign his commissionership. Mayor Strong, who was prevented by the Power of Removals Act from dismissing him without trial, asked Roosevelt to draw up a list of 5 formal charges, including neglected duty, malfeasance, and misfeasance. For some reason, the charge of personal corruption was not among them. There was yet another, much more devastating charge, which Roosevelt could have used had he wanted to. The story, as told by Jacob Riis, sounds apocryphal, but it has been confirmed by 2 independent sources. I was in his office one day, that June, when a police official of superior rank came in and requested private audience with him. They stepped aside, and the policeman spoke in an undertone, urging something strongly. Mr. Roosevelt listened. Suddenly I saw him straighten up as a man recoils from something unclean and dismiss the other with a sharp, "No, sir, I don't fight that way." The policeman went out crestfallen. Roosevelt took 2 or 3 turns about the floor, struggling evidently with strong disgust. He told me afterward that the man had come to him with what he said was certain knowledge that his enemy, Parker, could be found that night in a known evil house uptown, which it was his alleged habit to visit. His proposition was to raid it then, and so get square. To the policeman, it must have seemed like throwing a good chance away. If Parker had been caught in flagrante delicto, he could doubtless have been persuaded to resign. But Roosevelt struck no blow below the belt. And so the 5 formal charges were served, and public hearings set to begin on 11 June in Mayor Strong's office. Elihu Root was appointed prosecutor, and General Benjamin F. Tracy, late of the Harrison administration and now a Platt intimate, announced he would appear for Parker. The trial, which dragged on sporadically until 8 July, proved to be anticlimactic and dull. The weakness of Roosevelt's charges was apparent from the start, and the evidence, droned out to the whir of electric fans, sounded trivial. It consisted largely of lists of meetings which Parker had missed and lists of documents he had allowed to pile up on his desk. General Tracy effectively proved that Roosevelt was no slouch at missing meetings himself when there were lucrative offers to speak out of town. He also suggested that Parker's reluctance to promote Brooks and McCullough might be justified, and got Roosevelt to admit that as president of the board, he had advanced several ill-qualified men in 1895 simply because they gave promise of being useful, in some cases not even bothering to check their records. One of the few entertaining moments of the proceedings came when Tracy deflated a Rooseveltian tirade thus. Roosevelt,
It was a long time before I could make up my mind about Mr. Parker. I struggled against it. I recognized his great ability. But at last I was forced to the conclusion that he was guilty of neglected duty, that he was mendacious, treacherous, capable of double-dealing and exercising a bad influence. Tracy, hasn't the whole trouble come from the fact that you had to yield to Mr. Parker?
Roosevelt,
no, sir. I'd be glad to yield to him if he was right.
Tracy, dryly,
you enjoy yielding to a man, don't you?
Roosevelt, with great energy,
by George, I do, and that's a fact.
He looked surprised, reported an onlooker, when the crowd shrieked with laughter. Parker, seated not 6 feet away, joined in the general mirth. Mayor Strong made no secret of his dissatisfaction with the evidence presented by the prosecution. In contrast, that of the defense was impressive. Grant and Conlon testified in Parker's praise, and Parker himself made a convincing witness. Relaxed, graceful, and articulate, he cited fact after fact which, in the words of the Sun, made him out as having been exceedingly active in the performance of his duties almost from the hour of his appointment. Roosevelt's loyal ally, the New York Times, was tempted to agree, and forecast that if Strong upheld the prosecution, Parker would be vindicated in court. Most other newspapers expected the mayor to dismiss the charges once the trial came to an end. As one editor pointed out, the real issue could not be legally considered. It was that irreconcilable personality differences made it impossible for Roosevelt and Parker to work democratically together. The only way of resolving it was for one of them to resign. And since both were proud men, that day might be long in coming. Dull as the Parker trial was, it might have sparked more interest had its first few sessions not coincided with the Republican National Convention in St. Louis. The petty tensions prevailing between prosecution and defense in Mayor Strong's office were as nothing compared with the huge forces then contending on the banks of the Mississippi. Yet, in a microscopic way, they reflected the party struggle. Here was a quiet, kindly man of bland political persuasion, William L. Strong / William McKinley, seeking to transcend the rivalry of an arrogant individualist, Theodore Roosevelt / Thomas B. Reed, and an organization man, Benjamin F. Tracy / Levi P. Morton. Of the participants in the trial, Roosevelt was by far the most adaptable in his candidate loyalty and the quickest to respond to what was going on in St. Louis. Since at least 1892, he had cherished the idea of electing Reed President of the United States. But his veneration for the speaker had begun to abate early in the new year. Reed, he now believed, was not firm enough on financial issues and not aggressive enough in recommending a larger navy. About the same time, Roosevelt had found it expedient to campaign in a few delegate primaries for Governor Morton of New York, Boss Platt's personal candidate. While doing so, he kept an uneasy eye on the candidacy of William McKinley. After leaving Congress in 1890, McKinley had twice been elected governor of Ohio, and the country now seemed ready to forgive him for his harsh policies as majority leader. Indeed, the financial panic of 1893 was now widely seen as the result of overreaction to McKinley's wise revisions of the tariff. Although Roosevelt had been favorably disposed toward McKinley in the past, at least as a person, he now felt sudden qualms. "It will be a great misfortune to have McKinley nominated," he wrote in one of the indiscretions Henry Cabot Lodge saw fit to delete from their published correspondence. "If I could tell you all I have learned since his campaign has progressed, you would be as completely alarmed over the prospect of his presidential nomination as I am." That was on 27 February. Less than a month later, he had acknowledged a great wave for McKinley sweeping over the country and expressed great disappointment with Reed. The latter's overbearing personality had alienated a considerable number of professional politicians. Roosevelt might forgive him that, but he could hardly approve the tone of a letter his friend sent him in late May, when McKinley emerged as the clear favorite for the nomination. "In a word, dear boy, I am tired of this thing. The receding grapes seem to ooze with acid, and the whole thing is a farce." On the eve of the trial, as Lodge prepared to depart for St. Louis, Roosevelt admitted that he was more interested in what happened at the convention than anything else. He told Bammy that he felt very nervous about its probable outcome.
"McKinley, whose firmness I utterly distrust, will be nominated, and this I much regret."
On 18 June 1896, news of the first ballot at St. Louis flashed over the wires to New York. McKinley had scored 661.5 votes to Reed's 84.5 and Governor Morton's 58. At once, Roosevelt's distrust of the candidate vanished, at least for public purposes. He was due to take the witness box that very day and used the occasion to make his political sympathies clear. Mr. Roosevelt, reported the New York Times, attracted the attention of the whole room by appearing with an ivory-colored button as large as a silver dollar, bearing the portraits of McKinley and vice presidential nominee Hobart. The faces could be distinguished across the room. Mr. Roosevelt was very proud of the emblem, which, he said, was the first of its kind to reach New York. All concerned with the case, excepting Mr. Parker, seemed interested in it. Commissioner Roosevelt submitted it to close inspection with infinite good nature and evident gratification. Only in private did he continue to express reservations. "While I greatly regret the defeat of Reed, who was in every way McKinley's superior, I am pretty well satisfied with the outcome at St. Louis. McKinley himself is an upright and honorable man, of very considerable ability and good record as a soldier and in Congress. He is not a strong man, however, and unless he is well backed, I should feel rather uneasy about him in a serious crisis." Mayor Strong added to Roosevelt's sense of unease by fleeing New York as soon as the trial was over, saying that he wished to soothe his rheumatism and consider his verdict in the mud baths of Richfield Springs.
"I will do nothing in the matter for several weeks."
Roosevelt was left to ponder the larger implications of McKinley's nomination. He could also look forward to a resumption of hostilities with Commissioner Parker. A creeping distaste for the job of police commissioner becomes apparent in Roosevelt's correspondence from the summer of 1896 onward. He had never found the work attractive. Grimy was his most frequent adjective. Yet up until his confrontation with Parker, he had exulted in its sheer bruising volume, as a strong man exults in shifting tons of rubble. But the collapse of his legal move against Parker, coinciding as it did with the emergence of William McKinley as the likely next president of the United States, made him realize that he had achieved about as much as he ever would in Mulberry Street. He summed up his feelings in an unusually revealing letter to Bammy, written with an air of finality, as if he had already resigned. "I have been so absorbed by my own special work and its ramifications that I have time to keep very little in touch with anything outside of my own duties. I see but little of the life of the great world. I am but little in touch even with our national politics. The work of the police board has nothing of the purple in it. It is as grimy as all work for municipal reform over here must be for some decades to come. And it is inconceivably arduous, disheartening, and irritating. I have to contend with the hostility of Tammany and the almost equal hostility of the Republican machine. I have to contend with the folly of the reformers and the indifference of decent citizens. Above all, I have to contend with the singularly foolish law under which we administer the department. If I were a single-headed commissioner with absolute power, I could in a couple of years accomplish almost all I could desire. But as it is, I am one of four commissioners, each of whom possesses a veto power in promotions. Add to this a hostile legislature, a bitterly antagonistic press, an unscrupulous scoundrel as controller. However, I have faced it as best I could, and I have accomplished something." His use of the phrase "a couple of years," while possibly unconscious, is interesting. Projected from his acceptance of the commissionership in April 1895, it indicates that Roosevelt was looking forward to another offer in April 1897, in other words, about the time the new president would be making appointments. It was useless to hope for a cabinet post, such as Thomas B. Reed would have given him, but if he ingratiated himself with McKinley now, and worked hard to ensure his election in November, he might count on some fairly high-level job next spring. He needed no time to decide which particular appointment to push for. One area of national policy interested him more than any other, in view of what he saw as a gathering threat to American security in the Caribbean and Atlantic. Paging at random through his list of extracurricular activities in the months preceding the convention, one finds him dining with Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan in February, criticizing the weakness of Secretary Herbert's Navy message in March, pumping the German diplomat Speck von Sternberg for accurate Teutonic information on world naval affairs in April, and spending a rather naval week in May, during which he inspects the Indiana from top to bottom and lunches on the Montgomery as she lies in the sun off Staten Island. In between times, he reads A Life of Admiral James, a 2-volume British tome on modern ironclads, and Lord Brassey's Naval Annual for 1896. He maintains a running correspondence with his new brother-in-law, Lieutenant Commander William Sheffield Cowles, USN, writing in June, "Brassey evidently thinks our battleships inferior to the British because of their 6-inch quick-firers. I'm not at all sure they are right, though I dislike the superimposed turrets." Finally, in July, he invites an old friend of William McKinley to visit him at Sagamore Hill. She arrives on the first day of August. Although the weather is very hot, he insists on rowing her across the glaring waters of Oyster Bay. As his oars spasmodically rise and fall, he tells her, "I should like to be Assistant Secretary of the Navy." Chapter 21. The Glorious Retreat. Then forth from the chamber in anger he fled, and the wooden stairway shook with his tread. In addressing himself to Mrs. Bellamy Storer rather than Mr. Bellamy Storer, Roosevelt flatteringly acknowledged that lady's superior political muscle. He had known her since his early Washington days, and had plenty of opportunity to see her in action as a lobbyist for the Roman Catholic Church. Mrs. Storer was a wealthy and formidable matron, whose eyes burned with religious fervor, and whose jaw brooked no opposition from anybody, least of all William McKinley, whom she considered to be in her debt. The presidential candidate had gratefully accepted $10,000 of Storer funds in 1893, when threatened with financial and political ruin. Mrs. Storer was now, 3 years later, expecting to recoup this investment in the form of various appointments for her near and dear. Roosevelt knew that she was fond of him in an amused, motherly sort of way. She tended, like Edith, to treat him as if he were one of her own children. Years later, when events had conspired to embitter her toward him, she wrote that the peculiar attraction and fascination of the young Theodore Roosevelt lay in the fact that he was like a child, with a child's spontaneous outbursts of affection, of fun, and of anger, and with the brilliant brain and fancy of a child. Shrewdly playing upon her maternal sympathies in 1896, he said that his political unpopularity in New York was now so great that the future security of the Roosevelt Bunnies depended on his getting a high-level post in Washington. Should he fail to negotiate one, or should McKinley, God forbid, fail to win election, "I shall be the melancholy spectacle of an idle father writing books that do not sell." Mrs. Storer told him that she was sure something could be arranged. She and her husband would speak to McKinley in due course. Roosevelt, overjoyed, promised in return to work up support on the Republican National Committee for Bellamy Storer as a cabinet officer or ambassador. The atmosphere in the rowboat grew increasingly cozy, and for the rest of her visit, Mrs. Storer basked in Roosevelt's good humor. One never knew what he would say next. He was certainly very witty in himself, and he valued wit in others. He used during this period to get on the warpath over Sienkiewicz's novels, The Deluge and Fire and the Sword, and when he was quite sated with slaughter, his face would be radiant, and he would shout aloud with delight. He seemed as innocent as Toddy in Helen's Babies, who wanted everything to be bluggy. His vituperation was extremely amusing, and he had a most extraordinary vocabulary. Never in our lives have we laughed so often as when Theodore Roosevelt of those days was our host. For all the optimism flowing out of Sagamore Hill that summer weekend, Roosevelt and the Storers were uncomfortably aware of the proximity, in New York's Waldorf Hotel, of a Cleveland millionaire who could turn their hopes to dust if he felt like it. Marcus Alonzo Hanna was more than McKinley's manager and closest political advisor. He was now the party chairman as well. In this double role, he stood confirmed as the first countrywide political boss in American history. Cynical Democrats were saying that Hanna, not McKinley, had been nominated at St. Louis. Cartoonists depicted the candidate as a limp puppet hanging out of his pocket. Roosevelt, reacting as usual with electric speed to any new political stimulus, had already been to see Hanna twice. On 28 July, the same day the chairman arrived in town to set up Republican national headquarters, he visited him at the Waldorf. In the evening, he had returned to dine privately with him and two members of the executive committee. A letter to Lodge, dated 30 July, shows how quickly and accurately he summed Hanna up. "He is a good-natured, well-meaning, coarse man, shrewd and hard-headed, but neither very far-sighted nor very broad-minded, and as he has a resolute and imperious mind, he will have to be handled with some care. Roosevelt does not seem to have told the Storers about these two previous meetings with Hanna. Possibly he wished them to follow an independent line with McKinley. At any rate, he visited the chairman again on Monday evening, 3 August, and fulfilled his part of the weekend bargain. Whether he did so quite as forcefully as he afterward implied to Mrs. Storer, "I spoke of Bellamy as the man for the cabinet, either for war or navy, or else go to France," is doubtful, since Hanna was tired and in no mood to discuss anything other than ways and means of winning in November. Roosevelt thought it wise not to pursue the matter further. Hanna's exhaustion was nervous as well as physical. After nearly 2 years of working with full-time devotion to secure the nomination of McKinley, at a personal cost of $100,000, he wanted nothing so much as to take a long cruise up the New England coast and let other Republicans manage the fall campaign. But a certain phenomenon, occurring in Chicago on 10 July, had changed everything, in his opinion. Alarming predictions of class war, communism, and even anarchy were coming in daily from the West. The political future suddenly seemed fraught with doom. Now was the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party, and Hanna bent his stout body to the task. Word went out from headquarters that he needed all the money and all the stump speakers he could get. Roosevelt, having little of the former, promptly volunteered to be one of the latter. The phenomenon in Chicago was that of William Jennings Bryan, an obscure 36-year-old ex-congressman from Nebraska, who by making one speech to the Democratic National Convention had created something akin to an emotional earthquake. Rising to speak on a currency resolution, Bryan had pleaded inspiringly for those rural poor to whom questions of high finance were of less importance than food and shelter. As a result, he was now the Democratic candidate for president, on a ticket so extremely radical as to cause large numbers of his party to bolt. Yet nobody, and certainly not Mark Hanna, discounted the threat he posed to William McKinley. For Bryan had that most potent of all political weapons, a sumptuous, sonorous voice, upon which he played like an open diapason. He also had a natural constituency, the farmers and field hands of the South, Midwest, and West, not to mention those disadvantaged millions, Reese's other half, who labored in farms and mines, or begged for work at factory doors, and lined up for soup in filthy municipal kitchens. Such people were ravished by his promises of dollars, more dollars for everybody, unlimited silver dollars, which could be produced by the simple method of minting them freely and cheaply at a ratio of 16 to 1. The much more expensive gold dollars, which McKinley proposed to keep in circulation, were just too few to go around, or so Bryan seemed to be saying. His listeners might not quite grasp why one ratio was preferable to another, and phrases like "international agreement for bimetallism" meant little to cornhuskers who had never seen more than a few square miles of Iowa. But they thought they could understand his magnificently vague metaphors, particularly the one with which he turned Chicago's Coliseum into a howling madhouse. "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." This was the phenomenon with which Mark Hanna had to deal in August 1896, and it is no wonder that he cut Roosevelt short on the subject of Bellamy Storer. But he accepted his visitor's offer of campaign help. Perhaps the chairman, in the back of his mind, recalled that other Chicago convention when he and McKinley had seen this same young man briefly, raspingly capture the attention of 7,000 delegates. Roosevelt liked Hanna. There was something engagingly pig-like about the man, with his snouty nostrils, thick pink skin, and short, trotting steps. His very business was in pig iron, and he had a grunting disdain for fine food and polite conversation. When he laughed, which was often, he snorted, and his language reeked of the farmyard. Yet Hanna's very fleshiness, his love of reaching out and touching, was attractive to someone as physical as Roosevelt. Hanna had none of old Tom Platt's dry secretiveness. He was blunt, honest, friendly, and unassuming, shamelessly addicted to sweets, which he would suck all day in his large, loose mouth. But for all his naturalness, the chairman was obviously a man of calculating intelligence. "X-rays," wrote one who met him at this time, "are not more penetrating than Hanna's glance." Surprisingly, for someone with so much power, the chairman was not corrupt. He had no desire for cabinet office. His ambition, as he reminded Roosevelt, was to elect McKinley. His love for that placid politician was as frank as it was naive.
"He is the best man I ever knew," or "McKinley is a saint."
As for the millions he had set out to raise, Hanna was too rich to want anything for himself. He treated campaign contributions much as he did iron ore in his Cleveland foundry, as raw material to be amassed in great quantities for the smelting of something solid. And indeed, McKinley had an amusingly metallic quality with his expressionless, perfectly cast features. Hanna had no doubt that in forging him, he had created an ideal president, a man of steel to symbolize the new industrial age. The idea of William Jennings Bryan bringing back the age of agriculture was more than regressive. It was revolutionary. Roosevelt could not help but be affected by the chairman's worried mood. Before their meeting on 3 August, he had been confident of a Republican victory in November. But after it, he wrote gloomily to Cecil Spring Rice, "If Bryan wins, we have before us some years of social misery, not markedly different from that of any South American republic. Bryan closely resembles Thomas Jefferson, whose accession to the presidency was a terrible blow to this nation." With that characteristic thrust, he braced himself for the biggest administrative challenge of his career as commissioner, Bryan's imminent arrival in Manhattan. The Democratic candidate had chosen Madison Square Garden, of all places, to open his campaign on 12 August, and Roosevelt, as president of the Board of Police, would be responsible for protecting his Jeffersonian person. It would be unfair to accuse Roosevelt of deliberately allowing the Bryan meeting to degenerate into a noisy, embarrassing shambles. However, he was conspicuous by his absence from the garden that night, and supervision of the crowd was left in the hands of a Republican inspector. The police proved remarkably adept at allowing gatecrashers in and keeping ticket holders out. Next morning, the Sun and News excoriated Teddy's recruits for gross incompetence and inefficiency, and even the Times agreed that the job was very bunglingly done. Bryan, however, was the real culprit of the evening. No degree of police efficiency could have altered the fact that he was a stupendous disappointment. For once, his oratorical gifts deserted him. Intimidated by the size of his audience, he merely read a prepared text on silver, which dragged on for 2 hours, to a steady tramp of exiting feet and calls of, "Good night, Billy!" "Bryan fell with a bang," Roosevelt crowed to Bammy. "He was so utter a failure that he dared not continue his eastern trip and canceled his Maine and Vermont engagements. I believe that the tide has begun to flow against him." When Bork Cochran, another celebrated speaker, took over the garden on 19 August to put the case of gold, Roosevelt was there to prevent any repetition of the previous week's fiasco. He personally supervised all security arrangements, and the evening went off smoothly. It was agreed next morning that the police had retrieved their reputations. With several weeks to spare before plunging into his agreed schedule of speaking engagements, Roosevelt decided to go west for his first hunting vacation in 2 years. But first he was determined to settle once and for all the vexed question of Brooks and McCullough. Commissioner Parker was still boycotting promotion meetings and using a variety of other tactics to perpetuate the deadlock. The mayor's continued reluctance to announce a verdict on the trial charges, Strong hated confrontations and feebly hoped that Parker had learned his lesson, made it imperative that something be done. On the morning after the Cochran meeting, Parker happened to be at police headquarters, and Roosevelt promptly announced a special session of the board for the purpose of acting on the inspectorship question. Hoping to force Parker into at least a statement of his still-secret objections to the two acting inspectors, Andrews called for a vote on their immediate promotion. He, Roosevelt, and Grant voted aye. Parker, instead of voting, began a monologue of ambiguous dissent, whereupon Roosevelt lost his temper. Andrews quit the meeting in disgust, and even Grant showed signs of vague irritation as the two rivals leaped to their feet and began shaking their fists at each other. Eventually, Roosevelt, thinking he had made a point, pounded the table and roared, "Case closed!" Although it manifestly was not, he stormed out of the room. "My, how you frighten me!" Parker called after him, then leaned back in his chair, tilted his head to the ceiling, and laughed for a long time. The following morning, Roosevelt left for North Dakota, clutching in his hand a new small-bore smokeless powder Winchester, a .31-66 with a half-jacketed bullet, the front or point of naked lead, the butt plated with hard metal. During the next 3 weeks, he grew burly and tanned from sleeping all night in the open and riding all day across the prairie. The Winchester gave him the greatest satisfaction, he wrote to Bammy. Certainly it was as wicked shooting a weapon as I ever handled, and knocked the bucks over with a sledgehammer. With his belly full of antelope meat and the oily perfume of sage in his nostrils, he rejoiced in rediscovering his other self, that almost forgotten doppelganger who haunted the plains while Commissioner Roosevelt patrolled the streets of Manhattan. For the 1,000th time, he pondered the dynamic interdependence of East and West. No force of nature, surely, not even the anarchistic Bryan, with his talk of grass growing in the streets of cities, could sunder those two poles, nor for that matter bring them any closer together. American energy lay in their mutual repulsion and mutual attraction. The money men of the East would vote for McKinley, of course. Bryan had already seen he could make no headway there. It was here in the West that the battle between gold and silver, capitalism and populism, industry and agriculture, must be fought out. From talking to his cowboys and to friends he met in the depot in St. Paul, and to the staff of party headquarters in Chicago, Roosevelt returned to New York on 10 September, convinced that the drift is our way. He serenely articulated his thoughts to an Evening Post reporter. The battle is going to be decided in our favor because the hundreds and thousands of farmers, workingmen, and merchants all through the West have been making up their minds that the battle should be waged on moral issues. It is in the West that as a nation we shall ultimately work out our highest destiny. But his surge of confidence did not last long. By mid-September, the battle initiative was clearly with the Democrats. A campaign map of the United States showed the frightening smallness of McKinley's constituency: New England, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, as opposed to the vast spread of states loyal to Bryan, the whole South plus Texas, and all of the mountain states. The Democratic candidate seemed to be everywhere, his big body tireless, and his melodious voice unfailing. Republican planners, attempting to plot his every whistle stop, stippled the Midwest with as many as 24 new dots a day. In some areas, the concentration was so dense as to shade the paper gray. Now the dots were beginning to creep ominously across the Mississippi, into the traditionally Republican plain states, every one of which had been reclassified as doubtful. Roosevelt, like Hannah, began to feel pangs of real dread. He was appalled at Bryan's ability to inflame with bitter rancor towards the well-off those who, whether through misfortune or through misconduct, have failed in life. Remarks like these suggest that Roosevelt, for all his public attacks upon the predatory rich, for all his night walks through the Lower East Side, was congenitally unable to understand the poor. People who lacked wealth, even through misfortune, had failed in life. Their votes, however, mattered. So he threw himself ardently into the campaign. Taking advantage of some space in Review of Reviews, which he was supposed to fill with an article on the vice presidency, Roosevelt assailed the populists, Bryan's third-party backers on the extreme left, to witty effect. Refinement and comfort they are apt to consider quite as objectionable as immorality. That a man should change his clothes in the evening, that he should dine at any other hour than noon, impress these good people as being symptoms of depravity instead of merely trivial. A taste for learning and cultivated friends, and a tendency to bathe frequently, caused them the deepest suspicion. Senator Tillman's brother has been frequently elected to Congress upon the issue that he wore neither an overcoat nor an undershirt. This and a fiery New York speech criticizing the Democratic platform's bias in favor of unrestricted job action, it is fitting that with the demand for free silver should go the demand for free riot. So delighted Republican headquarters that he was sent to barnstorm upstate with Henry Cabot Lodge. In a 5-day swing from Utica to Buffalo, the two friends spoke to packed, respectful houses and were encouraged by a general intent desire to listen to full explanations of the questions at issue. Before returning to New York and Boston, they paid a brief call on William McKinley at his home in Canton, Ohio. Here, the Republican candidate was conducting a front porch campaign eminently suited to his sedentary personality. Owing to the convenient ill health of Mrs. McKinley, he had announced early on that he would eschew the stump. It was arranged consequently, writes a contemporary historian, that inasmuch as McKinley could not go to the people must come to McKinley. The railroads, having much to gain by his election, were glad to cooperate with cheap group excursion rates from all over the country. Every day except Sunday, several train loads of party faithful would arrive in Canton and march up North Market Street to the beat of brass bands. Passing under a giant plaster arch adorned with McKinley's portrait, they would break ranks outside his white frame house and crowd onto the front lawn. The candidate would then appear and listen benignly to a speech of salutation which he had himself edited in advance. In reply, McKinley would read a speech of welcome, then make himself available for handshakes on the porch steps. Occasionally, he would invite some favored guests to stay for lunch or dinner. It is unlikely that Roosevelt and Lodge were granted this privilege. McKinley could hardly forget that they had supported Reed against him for the speakership in 1890 and for the presidential nomination earlier that year.
"He was entirely pleasant with us," Roosevelt reported to Bammy, "though we are not among his favorites."
Roosevelt spent the first full week of October on the hustings in New York City, expounding the merits of gold to all and sundry, and trying to persuade a rich uncle to lunch with Mark Hanna. He was amused by the old gentleman's horrified refusal. It was the traditional Knickerbocker disdain for dirty politicians. Nouveau riche millionaires like James J. Hill and John D. Rockefeller had no such scruples, and the chairman made the most of their huge contributions. Some 120 million books, pamphlets, posters, and preset newspaper articles poured out of Republican headquarters into all the doubtful states, while 1,400 speakers, including such luminaries as ex-President Harrison, Speaker Reed, and Carl Schurz, made expense-paid trips into every corner of the country. Masterful, tireless, and increasingly optimistic as this educational campaign caught fire, Mark Hanna supervised every itinerary and checked every invoice. One of the chairman's tactical decisions was to cancel a plan to send Roosevelt into Maryland and West Virginia. Instead, he was put on Bryan's trail in Illinois, Michigan, and Minnesota during the second and third weeks of the month. Hanna obviously believed him to be an ideal foil to the Democratic candidate. An Easterner whom Westerners revered, an intellectual who could explain the complexities of the gold standard in terms a cowboy could understand. Roosevelt more than justified his faith. Oversimplifying brilliantly, as he sped from whistle stop to whistle stop, he spoke in parables and brandished an array of homely visual symbols, including gold and silver coins and odd-sized loaves of bread.
"See this big one? This is an 8-cent loaf when the cents count on a gold basis. Now look at this small one. On a silver basis, it would sell for over 9 cents.
En route, he discovered that audiences enjoyed his natural gifts of vituperation as much, if not more, than financial argument. So day by day, the pejoratives flowed more freely. He scored his biggest success on 15 October in the Chicago Coliseum, where 3 months before Bryan had made the famous Cross of Gold speech. An audience of 13,000 rejoiced as Teddy, the name was all but universal now, went about his familiar business of emasculating the opposition.
"It is not merely schoolgirls that have hysterics. Very vicious mob leaders have them at times, and so do well-meaning demagogues when their minds are turned by the applause of men of little intelligence."
Warming to this theme, he compared Bryan and various other prominent free silverites and populists to the leaders of the Terror of France in mental and moral attitude. But he added reassuringly that such men lacked the revolutionary power of Marat, Barrère, and Robespierre. Bryan, who sought to benefit one class by stealing the wealth of another, wished to negate the Eighth Commandment, while Governor Altgeld of Illinois, having recently pardoned the Haymarket rioters,
"those foulest of criminals, the men whose crimes take the form of assassination," was clearly in violation of the Sixth.
Aware that his audience contained a large proportion of college boys, he warned against the seductions of the visionary social reformer, the being who reads Tolstoy or, if he possesses less intellect, Bellamy and Henry George, who studies Karl Marx and Proudhon, and believes that at this stage of the world's progress, it is possible to make everyone happy by an immense social revolution, just as other enthusiasts of a similar mental caliber believe in the possibility of constructing a perpetual motion machine. As always, the harshness of Roosevelt's words was softened by his beaming fervor, the sophomoric relish with which he pronounced his insults. For 2 hours he talked on, juggling his coins and loaves, grinning, grimacing, breathing sincerity from every pore, while the son of Abraham Lincoln sat behind him applauding, and the great hall resounded with cheers. Next morning, the Chicago Tribune awarded him lead status on its front page and printed his entire 7,000-word speech verbatim, running to almost 7 full columns of type. In many respects, the paper remarked, it was the most remarkable political gathering of the campaign in this city. There were 1 or 2 column inches of space left over after Roosevelt's peroration, and into this the editors inserted a filler, reporting an address elsewhere in the city on the same evening by an ex-Harvard professor, now head of the Department of Political Economy at the University of Chicago. One wonders with what feelings J. Lawrence Laughlin read of the triumph of his former pupil, whom 17 years before he had advised to go into politics. On his way home across Michigan, Roosevelt traveled so closely behind the campaign train of William Jennings Bryan that he was able to gauge local reactions to him at first hand. In one town, he actually caught up with Bryan and stood incognito in the crowd listening to him speak. Although there was no denying the beauty of the voice, nor the power of the eagle eye and big, confident body, he sensed that the average voter was curious rather than impressed. Bryan, he remarked on returning to New York, represented only that type of farmer whose gate hangs on one hinge, whose old hat supplies the place of a missing window pane, and who is more likely to be found at the Crossroads grocery store than behind the plow. Yet in spite of encouraging reports of a McKinley swing in the Midwest, we cannot help feeling uneasy until the victory is actually won. The last 10 days in October saw him hurrying from meeting to meeting in New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland. In between times, he geared the police force to ensure a rigorously honest election. Worn out and apprehensive as 3 November approached, he tried to convince himself that triumph was at hand, that he had done his part to avert the greatest crisis in our national fate save only the Civil War. William McKinley was elected president by an overwhelming plurality of 600,000 votes. His electoral college majority was 95. The total amount of votes cast was nearly 14 million. "We have submitted the issue to the American people," telegraphed William Jennings Bryan, "and their will is law." The Democratic candidate could afford to be magnanimous, having racked up some impressive statistics of his own. He had traveled 18,000 miles, addressed an estimated 5 million people, and was rewarded with the biggest Democratic vote in history. When Henry Cabot Lodge wondered if Bryan's party would hesitate before nominating him again, Mark Hanna had a typically vulgar retort. "Does a dog hesitate for a marriage license?" Hanna was now unquestionably the second most powerful man in America, and Roosevelt, celebrating with him at a Capuan victory luncheon on 10 November, felt a sudden twinge of revulsion at the part money and marketing had played in the campaign.
"He has advertised McKinley as if he were a patent medicine."
Looking around the room, he realized that at least half the guests were money men. The chairman might be easy in their company, but he, Roosevelt, was not.
"I felt as if I was personally realizing all of Brooks Adams's gloomy anticipations of our gold-ridden, capitalist-bestridden, usurer-mastered future."
But such scruples faded as he basked in the general glow of Republican triumph. McKinley was hailed as the advance agent of prosperity. Out of a magically cleared sky, the gold dollar shone down, promising fair economic weather for the last 4 years of the 19th century. Roosevelt felt more hopeful than after any election since that of 1888. Then, as now, his party had swept all 3 houses of the federal government and piled up luxurious pluralities in state legislatures. Then, as now, he had campaigned hard for the president-elect, knowing that his efforts would be rewarded. And so he waited with joyful anticipation for news of his appointment as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. It would probably come soon. Before November was out, Henry Cabot Lodge and the Dear Storers traveled separately to Canton to negotiate it. Lodge got there first on 29 November and lunched with McKinley the next day. He reported the conversation to Roosevelt with some delicacy. "He spoke of you with great regard for your character and your services, and he would like to have you in Washington. The only question he asked me was this, which I give you. I hope he has no preconceived plans which he would wish to drive through the moment he got in." I replied that he need not give himself the slightest uneasiness on that score.
Only Cabot Lodge, presumably, could make such an assurance with such a straight face. McKinley took it cordially enough, then changed the subject. Lodge felt cautiously optimistic at the end of the interview, but after all, I'm not one of his old supporters, and the person to whom I look now, having shot my own bolt, is Storer. What the latter said to McKinley a day or two later is not of record. It could not have been much, for Storer was understandably more interested in an office for himself. However, his forceful wife, who seems to have already looked beyond the McKinley administration to some future Roosevelt administration, was as good as her word. Buttonholing the president-elect after dinner, she pleaded Roosevelt's cause. McKinley studied her quizzically.
"I want peace," he said, "and I am told that your friend Theodore, whom I know only slightly, is always getting into rows with everybody. I am afraid he is too pugnacious."
"Give him a chance," Mrs. Storer replied, "to prove that he can be peaceful." McKinley received this solicitation as smoothly as he had Lodge's. He had the politician's gift of sending people away imagining that their requests would be granted, and Mrs. Storer, too, sent an optimistic letter to New York. She suggested that Roosevelt now visit McKinley himself to clinch the appointment. But desperately as he wanted it, pride would not let him.
"I don't wish to go to Canton unless McKinley sends for me. I don't think there's any need of it. He saw me when I went there during the campaign, and if he thinks I am hot-headed and harum-scarum, I don't think he'll change his mind now. Moreover, I don't wish to appear as a supplicant, for I am not a supplicant. I feel I could do good work as assistant secretary, but if we had proper police laws, I could do better work here and would not leave. And somewhere or other, I'll find work to do."
On 9 December, a letter from McKinley arrived on his desk. But it contained nothing more than a polite acknowledgment of the recommendation he had written for Bellamy Storer.
"Indeed, I do not think the assistant secretaryship in the least below what I ought to have," he wrote fretfully to Lodge.
His friend had perceived another obstacle in the way of his appointment, and suspected that it, rather than Roosevelt's belligerency, might be the real reason for McKinley's hesitation. This was the probable re-election, early in the new year, of Thomas C. Platt to the United States Senate. If Platt won, he would take his old seat in the Capitol on the same day McKinley entered the White House. And since the Republican majority in the Senate hinged on that very seat, McKinley would not dare to offend the easy boss by appointing any New Yorker he disapproved of. Lodge had already asked Platt what he thought about Roosevelt as assistant secretary and gotten a negative reaction. He did not feel ready to say that he would support you if you intended to go into the Navy Department and make war on him, or as he put it, on the organization. It followed, therefore, that if Roosevelt would not ingratiate himself with McKinley, he must ingratiate himself with Platt. One way or another, the unhappy commissioner must eat humble pie.
"I shall write Platt at once to get an appointment to see him," he replied.
The meeting was exceedingly polite but inconclusive. Platt's nomination for the Senate would not come up for another month, so there was no question of a premature deal. The old man was also waiting cruelly to see if Roosevelt would give active support to the nomination. His only rival was Joseph H. Choate, a distinguished liberal Republican who also happened to be Roosevelt's oldest political confidant. At Harvard, young Theodore had sought Choate's counsel as a substitute father. Choate had been one of the eminent citizens who backed his first campaign for the Assembly and had even offered to pay his expenses. After winning, Roosevelt had told Choate,
"I feel that I owe both my nomination and my election more to you than to any other one man."
Platt did not have to wait long for enlightenment. A day or two later, Choate's aides asked the police commissioner to speak for their candidate and were flatly turned down. On 16 December 1896, when organization men gathered at No. 4 Fifth Avenue to endorse the easy boss, Roosevelt was prominently present and seated at Platt's table. The approach of the festive season brought deep snow and zero temperatures, cooling the hot flush of politics. Roosevelt retired to Sagamore Hill to chop trees with his children. Little Ted, at 9 years old, was capable of bringing down a 60-foot oak, and though undersized, bore up wonderfully during 10-mile tramps. On Christmas Eve, the family slayed down, in patriarchal style, to Cove School, where Roosevelt played Santa Claus and distributed toys to the village children. He returned to Mulberry Street on 30 December for the year's final board meeting and found Commissioner Parker as tricky and obstructive as ever. After adjournment,
Roosevelt was moved to an admission of weary respect.
Parker, I feel to you as Tommy Atkins did toward Fuzzy Wuzzy in Kipling's poem. To fight him arf an hour will last me arf a year. I'm going out of town tonight, but I suppose we'll have another row next Wednesday.